himself, but he was not as confident of his acceptance as Mark. Mark took his barrel home, and Merthyn went inside to give Lola her supper. At sundown, Mark returned to the bell, and Merthyn walked with him up the main street as the warm afternoon turned into a chilly evening. The Guildhall had seemed like a fine building to Merthyn years ago, when he had stood here and presented his bridge design to the parish guild. But it appeared awkward and shabby now that he had seen the grand public buildings of Italy. He wondered what men such as Buonaventura Caroli and Loro Fiorentino must think of its rough stone undercroft, with the prison and the kitchen, and its main hall, with a row of pillars running awkwardly down the middle to support the roof. Mark introduced him to a handful of men who had arrived in Kingsbridge, or had come to prominence, in Merthyn's absence. However, most of the faces were familiar, albeit a little older. Merthyn greeted those few he had not already encountered in the last 2 days. Among these was Elfric, ostentatiously dressed in a brocade surcoat made with silver thread. He showed no surprise. Someone had obviously told him Merthyn was back, but glared with undisguised hostility. Also present were Prior Godwin and his sub-prior, Brother Philemon. Godwin, at 42, was looking more like his uncle Antony, Merthyn observed, with down-sloping lines of querulous discontent around his mouth. He put on a pretense of affability that might have fooled someone who did not know him. Philemon, too, had changed. He was no longer lean and awkward. He had filled out like a prosperous merchant, and carried himself with an air of arrogant self-assurance, although Merthyn fancied he could still see, underneath the facade, the anxiety and self-hatred of the fawning toady. Philemon shook his hand as if touching a snake. It was depressing to realize that old hatreds were so long-lived. A handsome, dark-haired young man crossed himself when he saw Merthyn, then revealed that he was Merthyn's former protégé, Jimmy, now known as Jeremiah Builder. Merthyn was delighted to find that he was doing well enough to belong to the parish guild. However, it seemed he was still as superstitious as ever. Mark mentioned the news about Princess Joan to everyone he spoke to. Merthyn answered one or two anxious questions about the plague, but the Kingsbridge merchants were more concerned that the collapse of the alliance with Castile would prolong the French war, which was bad for business. Elfric sat on the big chair in front of the giant woolsack scales and opened the meeting. Mark immediately proposed that Merthyn should be admitted as a member. Not surprisingly, Elfric objected. He was never a member of the guild because he did not finish his apprenticeship. "Because he wouldn't marry your daughter, you mean," said one of the men, and they all laughed. Merthyn took a few moments to identify the speaker. It was Bill Watkin, the house builder, the black hair around his bald dome now turning grey. "Because he is not a craftsman of the required standard," Elfric persisted stubbornly.
"How can you say that?" Mark protested. "He has built houses, churches, palaces, and our bridge, which is cracking after only 8 years. You built that, Elfric."
"I followed Merthyn's design exactly. Clearly the arches are not strong enough to bear the weight of the roadbed and the traffic upon it. The iron braces I have installed have not been sufficient to prevent the cracks widening. Therefore, I propose to reinforce the arches either side of the central pier, on both bridges, with a second course of masonry doubling their thickness. I thought this subject might come up tonight, so I have prepared estimates of the cost." Elfric must have started to plan this attack the moment he heard that Merthyn was back in town. He had always seen Merthyn as an enemy. Nothing had changed. However, he had failed to understand the problem with the bridge, and that gave Merthyn his chance. He spoke to Jeremiah in a low voice. "Would you do something for me? After all you did for me? Anything? Run to the priory now, and ask to speak to Sister Caris urgently. Tell her to find the original drawing I made for the bridge. It should be in the priory library. Bring it here right away." Jeremiah slipped out of the room. Elfric went on, "I must tell Guildsman that I have already spoken to Prior Godwin, who says the priory cannot afford to pay for this repair. We will have to finance it, as we finance the original cost of building the bridge, and be repaid out of penny tolls. They all groaned. There followed a long and bad-tempered discussion about how much money each member of the guild should put up. Merthyn felt animosity building up towards him in the room. This was undoubtedly what Elfric had intended. Merthyn kept looking at the door, willing Jeremiah to reappear. Bill Watkins said, "Maybe Merthyn should pay for the repairs, if it's his design that's at fault." Merthyn could not stay out of the discussion any longer. He threw caution to the winds. "I agree," he said. There was a startled silence. "If my design has caused the cracks, I'll repair the bridge at my own expense," he went on recklessly. Bridges were costly. If he was wrong about the problem, it could cost half his fortune. Bill said, "Handsomely said, I'm sure." Merthyn said, "But I have something to say, first, if guildsmen will permit." He looked at Elfric. Elfric hesitated, obviously trying to think of a reason for refusing, but Bill said, "Let him speak," and there was a chorus of assent. Elfric nodded reluctantly. "Thank you," said Merthyn. "When an arch is weak, it cracks in a characteristic pattern. The stones at the top of the arch are pressed downwards, so that their lower edges splay apart, and a crack appears at the crown of the arch on the intrados, at the underside."
"That's true," said Bill Watkin. "I've seen that sort of crack many a time. It's not usually fatal."
Merthyn went on, "This is not the type of cracking you're seeing on the bridge. Contrary to what Elfric said, those arches are strong enough. The thickness of the arch is 1/20th of its diameter at the base, which is the standard proportion in every country." The builders in the room nodded. They all knew that ratio. "The crown is intact. However, there are horizontal cracks at the springing of the arch either side of the central pier." Bill spoke again. "You sometimes see that in a quadripartite vault." "Which this bridge is not," Merthyn pointed out. "The vaults are simple."
"What's causing it, then?"
"Elfric did not follow my original design."
Elfric said, "I did."
"I specified a pile of large, loose stones at both ends of the piers."
"A pile of stones?" Elfric said mockingly. "And you say that's what was going to keep your bridge upright?"
"Yes, I do," Merthyn said. He could tell that even the builders in the room agreed with Elfric's skepticism, but they did not know about bridges, which were different from any other kind of building because they stood in water. The piles of stones were an essential part of the design.
"They were never in the drawings."
"Would you like to show us my drawings, Elfric, to prove your point? The tracing flaw is long gone." "I did a drawing on parchment. It should be in the Priory Library." Elfric looked at Godwin. At that moment, the complicity between the two men was blatant, and Merthyn hoped the rest of the guild could see it. Godwin said,
"Parchment is costly. That drawing was scraped and reused long ago."
Merthyn nodded as if he believed Godwin. There was still no sign of Jeremiah. Merthyn might have to win the argument without the help of the original plans. "The stones would have prevented the problem that is now causing the cracks," he said. Philemon put in,
"You would say that, wouldn't you? But why should we believe you? It's just your word against Elfric's."
Merthyn realized he would have to stick his neck out. "All or nothing," he thought. "I will tell you what the problem is, and prove it to you in daylight, if you will meet me at the riverside tomorrow at dawn." Elfric's face showed that he wanted to refuse this challenge, but Bill Watkin said,
"Fair enough. We'll be there."
"Bill, can you bring 2 sensible boys who are good swimmers and divers?"
"Easy."
Elfric had lost control of the meeting, and Godwin intervened, revealing himself as the puppet master.
"What kind of a mockery are you planning?" he said angrily.
But it was too late. The others were curious now.
"Let him make his point," said Bill. "If it's a mockery, we'll all know soon enough."
Just then, Jeremiah came in. Merton was pleased to see that he was carrying a wooden frame with a large sheet of parchment stretched across it. Elfrick stared at Jeremiah, shocked. Godwin looked pale and said, "Who gave you that?"
"A revealing question," Merthyn commented. "The Lord Prior doesn't ask what the drawing shows, nor where it came from. He seems to know all that already. He just wonders who handed it over."
Bill said, "Never mind all that. Show us the drawing, Jeremiah." Jeremiah stood in front of the scales and turned the frame around so that everyone could see the drawing. There at the ends of the piers were the piles of stones Merthyn had spoken of. Merthyn stood up. "In the morning, I'll explain how they work." Summer was turning into autumn, and it was chilly on the riverbank at dawn. News had somehow got around that a drama would take place, and, as well as the members of the parish guild, there were 200 or 300 people waiting to see the clash between Merthyn and Elfrick. Even Carus was there. This was no longer merely an argument about an engineering problem, Merthyn realized. He was the youngster, challenging the authority of the old bull, and the herd understood that. Bill Watkin produced 2 lads of 12 or 13, stripped to their undershorts and shivering. It turned out they were Mark Webber's younger sons, Dennis and Noah. Dennis, the 13-year-old, was short and chunky, like his mother. He had red-brown hair the colour of leaves in autumn. Noah, the younger by 2 years, was taller, and would probably grow up to be as big as Mark. Merthyn identified with the short redhead. He wondered whether Dennis was embarrassed, as Merthyn himself had been at that age, to have a younger brother who was bigger and stronger. Merthyn thought Elfrick might object to Mark's sons being the divers, on the grounds that they might have been briefed in advance by their father and told what to say. However, Elfrick said nothing. Mark was too transparently honest for anyone to suspect him of such duplicity, and perhaps Elfrick realized that, or, more likely, Godwin realized it. Merthyn told the boys what to do. "Swim out to the central pier, then dive. You'll find the pier is smooth for a long way down. Then there's the foundation, a great lump of stones held together with mortar. When you reach the riverbed, feel underneath the foundation. You probably won't be able to see anything. The water will be too muddy. But hold your breath for as long as you can and investigate thoroughly all around the base. Then come up to the surface and tell us exactly what you find." They both jumped into the water and swam out. Merthyn spoke to the assembled townspeople. "The bed of this river is not rock, but mud. The current swirls around the piers of a bridge and scours the mud out from underneath the pillars, leaving a depression filled only with water. This happened to the old wooden bridge. The oak piers were not resting on the riverbed at all, but hanging from the superstructure. That's why the bridge collapsed. To prevent the same thing happening to the new bridge, I specified piles of large rough stones around the feet of the piers. Such piles break up the current, so that its action is haphazard and weak. However, the piles were not installed, and so the piers have been undermined. They are no longer supporting the bridge, but hanging from it, and that's why there are cracks where the pier joins the arch." Elfrick snorted skeptically, but the other builders looked intrigued. The two boys reached midstream, touched the central pier, took deep breaths, and disappeared. Merthyn said, "When they come back, they will tell us that the pier is not resting on the riverbed, but hanging over a depression, filled with water, large enough for a man to climb into." He hoped he was right. Both boys stayed underwater for a surprisingly long time. Merthyn found himself feeling breathless, as it were in sympathy with them. At last a wet head of red hair broke the surface, then a brown one. The two boys conversed briefly, nodding, as if establishing that they had both observed the same thing. Then they struck out for the shore. Merthyn was not completely sure of his diagnosis, but he could think of no other explanation for the cracks, and he had felt the need to appear supremely confident. If he now turned out to be wrong, he would look all the more foolish. The boys reached the bank and waded out of the water, panting. Madge gave them blankets, which they pulled around their shaking shoulders. Merthyn allowed them a few moments to catch their breath, then said, "Well, what did you find?"
"Nothing," said Dennis, the elder.
"What do you mean, nothing?"
"There's nothing there, at the bottom of the pillar."
Elfrick looked triumphant. "Just the mud of the riverbed, you mean."
"No," said Dennis. "No mud, just water."
Noah put in, "There's a hole you could climb into, easily. That big pillar is just hanging in the water, with nothing under it." Merthyn tried not to look relieved. Elfrick blustered. "There's still no authority for saying a pile of loose stones would have solved the problem." But no one was listening to him. In the eyes of the crowd, Merthyn had proved his point. They gathered around him, commenting and questioning. After a few moments, Elfrick walked away alone. Merthyn felt a momentary pang of compassion. Then he recalled how, when he was an apprentice, Elfrick had hit him across the face with a length of timber, and his pity evaporated into the cold morning air. Chapter 56. The following morning, a monk came to see Merthyn at the bell. When he pulled back his hood, Merthyn did not at first recognize him. Then he saw that the monk's left arm was cut off at the elbow, and he realized it was Brother Thomas, now in his 40s, with a grey beard and deep-set lines around his eyes and mouth. Was his secret still dangerous after all these years? Merthyn wondered. Would Thomas's life be in danger even now, if the truth came out? But Thomas had not come to talk about that. "You were right about the bridge," he said. Merthyn nodded. There was a sour satisfaction in it. He had been right, but Prior Godwin had fired him, and in consequence his bridge would never be perfect. "I wanted to explain the importance of the rough stones, back then," he said, "but I knew Elfrick and Godwin would never listen to me. So I told Edmund Wooler, then he died." "You should have told me."
"I wish I had."
"Come with me to the church," Thomas said, "since you can read so much from a few cracks. I'd like to show you something, if I may." He led Merthyn to the south transept. Here and in the south aisle of the choir, Elfrick had rebuilt the arches, following the partial collapse 11 years ago. Merthyn saw immediately what Thomas was worrying about. The cracks had reappeared. "You said they would come back," Thomas said. "Unless you discovered the root cause of the problem, yes." "You were right. Elfrick was wrong twice." Merthyn felt a spark of excitement. If the tower needed to be rebuilt... "You understand that. But does Godwin?" Thomas did not answer the question. "What do you think the root cause might be?" Merthyn concentrated on the immediate problem. He had thought about this, on and off, for years. "This is not the original tower, is it?" he said. "According to Timothy's book, it has been rebuilt and made higher." "About 100 years ago, yes, when the raw wool business was booming." "Do you think they made it too high?"
"It depends on the foundations."
The site of the cathedral sloped gently to the south, towards the river, and that might be a factor. He walked through the crossing, under the tower, to the north transept. He stood at the foot of the massive pillar at the northeast corner of the crossing, and looked up at the arch that stretched over his head, across the north aisle of the choir, to the wall. "It's the south aisle I'm worried about," Thomas said slightly peevishly. "There are no problems here." Merthyn pointed up. "There's a crack on the underside of the arch, the intrados, at the crown," he said. "You get that in a bridge when the piers are inadequately grounded and start to splay apart."
"What are you saying? That the tower is moving away from the north transept?"
Merthyn went back through the crossing and looked at the matching arch on the south side. "This one is cracked too, but on the upper side, the extrados. Do you see? The wall above it is cracked too."
"They aren't very big cracks."
"But they tell us what is happening. On the north side, the arch is being stretched. On the south side, it's being pinched. That means the tower is moving south." Thomas looked up warily. It seems straight. You can't see it with the eye, but if you climb up into the tower and drop a plumb line from the top of one of the columns of the crossing, just below the springing of the arch, you will see that by the time the line touches the floor, it will be adrift of the column to the south by several inches, and, as the tower leans, it's separating from the wall of the choir, which is where the damage shows worst.
What can be done?
Merthyn wanted to say, you have to commission me to build a new tower, but that would have been premature. A lot more investigation before any building, he said, suppressing his excitement. We have established that the cracks have appeared because the tower is moving. But why is it moving?
And how will we learn that?
Dig a hole, Merthyn said. In the end, Jeremiah dug the hole. Thomas did not want to employ Merthyn directly. It was difficult enough as it was, he said, to get the money for the investigation out of Godwin, who seemed never to have any money to spare. But he could not give the job to Elfric, who would have said there was nothing to investigate. So the compromise was Merthyn's old apprentice. Jeremiah had learned from his master and liked to work fast. On the first day, he lifted the paving stones in the south transept. Next day, his men started excavating the earth around the huge southeast pier of the crossing. As the hole got deeper, Jeremiah built a timber hoist for lifting out loads of earth. By the second week, he had to build wooden ladders down the sides of the hole so that the laborers could get to the bottom. Meanwhile, the parish guild gave Merthyn the contract for the repair of the bridge. Elfric was against the decision, of course, but he was in no position to claim that he was the best man for the job, and he hardly bothered to argue. Merthyn went to work with speed and energy. He built cofferdams around the two problem piers, drained the dams, and began to fill the holes under the piers with rubble and mortar. Next, he would surround the piers with the piles of large, rough stones he had envisaged from the start. Finally, he would remove Elfric's ugly iron braces and fill the cracks with mortar. Provided the repaired foundations were sound, the cracks would not reopen. But the job he really wanted was the rebuilding of the tower. It would not be easy. He would have to get his design accepted by the priory and the parish guild, currently run by his two worst enemies, Godwin and Elfric. And Godwin would have to find the money. As a first step, Merthyn encouraged Mark to put himself forward for election as alderman to replace Elfric. The alderman was elected once a year on All Hallows Day, the 1st of November. In practice, most aldermen were re-elected unopposed until they retired or died. However, there was no doubt that a contest was permitted. Indeed, Elfric himself had put his name forward while Edmund Wooler was still in office. Mark required little prompting. He was itching to put an end to Elfric's rule. Elfric was so close to Godwin that there was not much point in having a parish guild at all. The town was, in effect, run by the priory. Narrow, conservative, mistrustful of new ideas, careless of the interests of the townspeople. So the two candidates began drumming up support. Elfric had his followers, mainly people he either employed or bought materials from. However, he had lost face badly in the argument over the bridge, and those who took his side were downcast. Mark's supporters, by contrast, were ebullient. Merthyn visited the cathedral every day and examined the foundations of the mighty column as they were exposed by Jeremiah's digging. The foundations were made of the same stone as the rest of the church, laid in careful mortared courses, but less carefully trimmed, as they would not be visible. Each course was a little wider than the one above, in a pyramid shape. As the excavation went deeper, he examined every layer for weakness, and found none. But he felt confident that eventually he would. Merthyn told no one what was in his mind. If his suspicions were correct, and the 13th century tower was simply too heavy for the 12th century foundations, the solution would be drastic. The tower would have to be demolished, and a new one built, and the new tower could be the tallest in England. One day in the middle of October, Carus appeared at the digging. It was early in the morning, and a winter sun was shining through the great east window. She stood on the edge of the hole with her hood around her head like a halo. Merthyn's heart beat faster. Perhaps she had an answer for him. He climbed up the ladder eagerly. She was as beautiful as ever, though in the strong sunlight he could see the little differences that 9 years had made to her face. Her skin was not quite as smooth, and there were now the tiniest of creases at the corners of her lips. But her green eyes still shone with that alert intelligence that he loved so much. They walked together down the south aisle of the nave, and stopped near the pillar that always reminded him of how he had once felt her up here. "I'm happy to see you," he said. "You've been hiding away."
"I'm a nun. I'm supposed to hide away."
"But you're thinking about renouncing your vows."
"I haven't made a decision."
He was crestfallen. "How much time do you need?"
"I don't know."
He looked away. He did not want to show her how badly he was hurt by her hesitation. He said nothing. He could have told her she was being unreasonable, but what was the point? "You'll be going to visit your parents in Tench at some point, I suppose," she said. He nodded.
"Quite soon.
They will want to see Lola." He was eager to see them, too, and had delayed only because he had become so deeply involved in his work on the bridge and the tower.
"In that case, I wish you would talk to your brother about Wulfric in Wigley."
Merthyn wanted to talk about himself and Caris, not Wulfric and Gwenda. His response was cool. "What do you want me to say to Ralph?"
"Wulfric is laboring for no money, just food, because Ralph won't give him even a small acreage to farm."
Merthyn shrugged. Wulfric broke Ralph's nose. He felt the conversation begin to descend into a quarrel, and he asked himself why he was angry. Caris had not spoken to him for weeks, but she had broken her silence for the sake of Gwenda. He resented Gwenda's place in her heart, he realized. That was an unworthy emotion, he told himself, but he could not shake it. Caris flushed with annoyance.
"That was 12 years ago. Isn't it time Ralph stopped punishing him?"
Merthyn had forgotten the abrasive disagreements he and Caris used to have, but now he realized this friction was familiar. He spoke dismissively. "Of course he should stop, in my opinion. But Ralph's opinion is the one that counts."
"Then see if you can change his mind," she said.
He resented her imperious attitude. "I'm yours to command," he said facetiously.
"Why the irony?"
"Because I'm not yours to command, of course, but you seem to think I am, and I feel a bit foolish for going along with you."
"Oh, for heaven's sake," she said. "You're offended that I've asked you."
For some reason, he felt sure she had made up her mind to reject him and stay in the nunnery. He tried to control his emotions. "If we were a couple, you could ask me anything. But while you're keeping open the option of rejecting me, it seems a bit presumptuous of you." He realized he was sounding pompous, but he could not stop. If he revealed his true feelings, he would burst into tears. She was too wrapped up in her indignation to notice his distress.
"But it's not even for myself," she protested.
"I realize it's your generosity of spirit that makes you do it, but I still feel you're using me."
"All right, then. Don't do it."
"Of course I'll do it." Suddenly he could no longer contain himself. He turned and walked away from her. He was shaking with some passion he could not identify. As he strode up the aisle of the great church, he struggled to get himself under control. He reached the excavation. This was stupid, he thought. He turned and looked back, but Caris had vanished. He stood at the lip of the hole, looking down, waiting for the storm inside him to subside. After a while, he realized that the excavation had reached a crucial stage. 30 feet below him, the men had dug down past the masonry foundations and were beginning to reveal what was beneath. There was nothing more he could do about Caris right now. It would be best to concentrate on his work. He took a deep breath, swallowed, and went down the ladder. This was the moment of truth. His distress over Caris began to ease as he watched the men dig farther down. Shovelful after shovelful of heavy mud was dug up and taken away.
Merthin studied the stratum of earth that was revealed below the foundations. It looked like a mixture of sand and small stones. As the men removed the mud, the sandy stuff dribbled into the hole they were making. Merthin ordered them to stop. He knelt down and picked up a handful of the sandy material. It was nothing like the soil all around. It was not natural to the site, therefore it must be something that had been put there by builders. The excitement of discovery rose inside him, overmastering his grief about Caris.
"Jeremiah," he called, "see if you can find Brother Thomas, quick as you like."
He told the men to carry on digging, but to make a narrower hole. At this point, the excavation itself could be dangerous to the structure. After a while, Jeremiah returned with Thomas, and the three of them watched as the men took the hole farther down. Eventually, the sandy layer came to an end, and the next stratum was revealed to be the natural muddy earth.
"I wonder what that sandy stuff is," Thomas said.
"I think I know," Merthin said. He tried not to look triumphant. He had predicted, years ago, that Elfric's repairs would not work unless the root of the problem was discovered, and he had been right. But it was never wise to say, "I told you so." Thomas and Jeremiah looked at him in anticipation. He explained, "When you've dug a foundation hole, you cover the bottom with a mixture of rubble and mortar. Then you lay the masonry on top of that. It's a perfectly good system, as long as the foundations are proportional to the building above."
Thomas said impatiently, "We both know this."
What happened here was that a much higher tower was erected on foundations that were not designed for it. The extra weight, acting over 100 years, has crushed that layer of rubble and mortar to sand. The sand has no cohesion, and under pressure, it has spread outwards into the surrounding soil, allowing the masonry above it to sink down. The effect is worse on the south side, simply because the site naturally slopes that way. He felt a profound satisfaction at having figured this out. The other two looked thoughtful. Thomas said, "I suppose we will have to reinforce the foundations." Jeremiah shook his head. "Before we can put any reinforcement under the stonework, we'd have to remove the sandy stuff, and that would leave the foundations unsupported. The tower would fall down." Thomas was perplexed. "So what can we do?" They both looked at Merthin. He said, "Build a temporary roof over the crossing, erect scaffolding, and take down the tower stone by stone. Then reinforce the foundations."
"Then we'd have to build a new tower."
That was what Merthin wanted, but he did not say so. Thomas might suspect that his judgment had been colored by his aspiration.
"I'm afraid so," he said with feigned regret. "Prior Godwin won't like that."
"I know," Merthin said, "but I don't think he's got any choice." Next day, Merthin rode out of Kingsbridge with Lola on the saddle in front of him. As they traveled through the forest, he obsessively ran over his fraught exchange with Caris. He knew he had been ungenerous. How foolish that was, when he was trying to win back her love. What had got into him? Caris's request was perfectly reasonable. Why would he not wish to perform a small service for the woman he wanted to marry? But she had not agreed to marry him. She was still reserving the right to reject him. That was the source of his anger. She was exercising the privileges of a fiancé without making the commitment. He could see now that it was petty of him to object on these grounds. He had been stupid, and turned what could have been a delightful moment of intimacy into a squabble. On the other hand, the underlying cause of his distress was all too real. How long did Caris expect him to wait for an answer? How long was he prepared to wait? He did not like to think about that. Anyway, it would do him nothing but good if he could persuade Ralph to stop persecuting poor Wulfric. Tench was on the far side of the county, and on the way Merthin spent a night at Windy Wigley. He found Gwenda and Wulfric thin after a rainy summer and the second poor harvest in a row. Wulfric's scar seemed to stand out more on a hollowed cheek. Their two small sons looked pale,
and had runny noses and sores on their lips. Merthin gave them a leg of mutton, a small barrel of wine, and a gold florin that he pretended were gifts from Caris. Gwenda cooked the mutton over the fire. She was possessed by rage, and she hissed and spat like the turning meat as she talked of the injustice that had been done to them. "Perkin has almost half the land in the village," she said. "The only reason he can manage it all is that he's got Wulfric, who does the work of three men. Yet he must demand more and keep us in poverty." "I'm sorry that Ralph still bears a grudge," Merthin said.
"Ralph himself provoked that fight," Gwenda said. "Even Lady Philippa said so."
"Old quarrels," Wulfric said philosophically. "I'll try to get him to see reason," Merthin said. "In the unlikely event that he listens to me, what do you really want from him?"
"Ah," said Wulfric, and he got a faraway look in his eyes, which was unusual for him.
"What I pray for every Sunday is to get back the lands that my father farmed."
"That will never happen," Gwenda said quickly. "Perkin is too well entrenched, and if he should die, he has a son and a married daughter waiting to inherit, and a couple of grandsons growing taller every day. But we'd like a piece of land of our own. For the last 11 years, Wulfric has been working hard to feed other men's children. It's time he got some of the benefit of his strength."
"I'll tell my brother he has punished you long enough," Merthin said. Next day he and Lolla rode from Waigley to Tench. Merthin was even more resolved to do something for Wulfric. It was not just that he wanted to please Caris and atone for his curmudgeonly attitude. He also felt sad and indignant that two such honest and hard-working people as Wulfric and Gwenda should be poor and thin, and their children sickly, just because of Ralph's vindictiveness. His parents were living in a house in the village, not in Tench Hall itself. Merthin was shocked by how much his mother had aged, though she perked up when she saw Lolla. His father looked better.
"Ralph is very good to us," Gerald said in a defensive way that made Merthin think the opposite.
The house was pleasant enough, but they would have preferred to live at the hall with Ralph. Merthin guessed that Ralph did not want his mother watching everything he did. They showed him around their home, and Gerald asked Merthin how things were in Kingsbridge. "The town is still prospering, despite the effects of the King's French War," Merthin replied.
"Ah, but Edward must fight for his birthright," his father said. "He is the legitimate heir to the throne of France, after all."
"I think that's a dream, father," said Merthin. "No matter how many times the king invades, the French nobility will not accept an Englishman as their king, and a king can't rule without the support of his earls."
"But we had to stop the French raids on our south coast ports. That hasn't been a major problem since the Battle of Sluys, when we destroyed the French fleet, which was 8 years ago. Anyway, burning the crops of the peasants won't stop pirates. It might even add to their numbers. The French support the Scots, who keep invading our northern counties. Don't you think the king would be better able to deal with Scottish incursions if he were in the north of England, rather than the north of France?"
Gerald looked baffled. It had probably never occurred to him to question the wisdom of the war.
"Well, Ralph has been knighted," he said, "and he brought your mother a silver candlestick from Calais."
That was about the size of it, Merthin thought. The real reason for the war was booty and glory. They all walked to the manor house. Ralph was out hunting with Alan Fernhill. In the great hall was a huge carved wooden chair, obviously the lord's. Merthin saw what he thought was a young servant girl, heavily pregnant, and was dismayed to be introduced to her as Ralph's wife, Tilly. She went to the kitchen to fetch wine.
"How old is she?" Merthin said to his mother while she was gone.
14.
It was not unknown for girls to become pregnant at 14, but all the same Merthin felt that decent people behaved otherwise. Such early pregnancies usually happened in royal families, for whom there was intense political pressure to produce heirs, and among the lowest and most ignorant of peasants, who knew no better. The middle classes maintained higher standards.
"She's a bit young, isn't she?" he said quietly.
Maud replied,
We all asked Ralph to wait, but he would not. Clearly she, too, disapproved.
Tilly returned with a servant carrying a jug of wine and a bowl of apples. She might have been pretty, Merthyn thought, but she looked worn out. His father addressed her with forced jollity.
Cheer up, Tilly. Your husband will be home soon. You don't want to greet him with a long face.
I'm fed up with being pregnant, she said. I just wish the baby would come as soon as possible. It won't be long now, Maud said. 3 or 4 weeks, I'd say. That seems like forever.
They heard horses outside. Maud said,
That sounds like Ralph.
Waiting for the brother he had not seen for 9 years, Merthyn had mixed feelings, as ever. His affection for Ralph was always contaminated by his knowledge of the evil Ralph had done. The rape of Annette had been only the beginning. During his days as an outlaw, Ralph had murdered innocent men, women, and children. Merthyn had heard, travelling through Normandy, of the atrocities perpetrated by King Edward's army, and, while he did not know specifically what Ralph had done, it would have been foolish to hope that Ralph had held himself aloof from that orgy of rape, burning, looting, and slaughter. But Ralph was his brother. Ralph, too, would have mixed feelings, Merthyn was sure. He might not have forgiven Merthyn for giving away the location of his outlaw hideout. And although Merthyn had made Brother Thomas promise not to kill Ralph, he had known that Ralph, once captured, was likely to be hanged. The last words Ralph had spoken to Merthyn, in the jail in the basement of the Guildhall at Kingsbridge, were, "You betrayed me." Ralph came in with Alan, both muddy from the hunt. Merthyn was shocked to see that he walked with a limp. Ralph took a moment to recognize Merthyn. Then he smiled broadly.
"My big brother," he said heartily.
It was an old joke. Merthyn was the elder, but had long been smaller. They embraced. Merthyn felt a surge of warmth, despite everything. At least we're both alive, he thought, despite war and plague. When they had parted, he had wondered whether they would ever meet again. Ralph threw himself into the big chair.
"Bring some beer, we're thirsty," he said to Tilly.
There were to be no recriminations, Merthyn gathered. He studied his brother. Ralph had changed since that day in 1339, when he had ridden off to war. He had lost some of the fingers of his left hand, presumably in battle. He had a dissipated look. His face was veined from drink, and his skin seemed dry and flaky. "Did you have good hunting?" Merthyn asked.
"We brought home a roe deer as fat as a cow," he replied with satisfaction. "You shall have her liver for supper."
Merthyn asked him about fighting in the army of the king, and Ralph related some of the highlights of the war. Their father was enthusiastic.
"An English knight is worth 10 of the French," he said. "The Battle of Crecy proved that."
Ralph's response was surprisingly measured. "An English knight is not much different from a French knight, in my opinion," he said. "But the French haven't yet understood the harrow formation in which we line up, with archers either side of dismounted knights and men-at-arms. They are still charging us suicidally, and long may they continue. But they will figure it out one day, and then they will change their tactics. Meanwhile, we are almost unbeatable in defense. Unfortunately, the harrow formation is irrelevant to attack, so we have ended up winning very little." Merthyn was struck by how his brother had grown up. Warfare had given him a depth and subtlety he had never previously possessed. In turn, Merthyn talked about Florence, the incredible size of the city, the wealth of the merchants, the churches and palaces. Ralph was particularly fascinated by the notion of slave girls. Darkness fell, and the servants brought lamps and candles, then supper. Ralph drank a lot of wine. Merthyn noticed that he hardly spoke to Tilly. Perhaps it was not surprising. Ralph was a 31-year-old soldier who had spent half his adult life in an army, and Tilly was a girl of 14 who had been educated in a nunnery. What would they have to talk about? Late in the evening, when Gerald and Maud had returned to their own house and Tilly had gone to bed, Merthyn broached the subject Caris had asked him to raise.
He felt more optimistic than previously. Ralph was showing signs of maturity. He had forgiven Merthyn for what had happened in 1339, and his cool analysis of English and French tactics had been impressively free from tribal chauvinism. Merthyn said, "On my way here, I spent a night in Wigley. I see that fulling mill stays busy. The scarlet cloth has become a good business for Kingsbridge." Ralph shrugged. "Mark Webber pays the rent on time. It was beneath the dignity of noblemen to discuss business." "I stayed with Gwenda and Wulfric," Merthyn went on. "You know that Gwenda has been Caris's friend since childhood. I remember the day we all met Sir Thomas Langley in the forest." Merthyn shot a quick glance at Alan Fernhill. They had all kept their childish vows and had not told anyone about that incident. Merthyn wanted the secrecy to continue, for he sensed it was still important to Thomas, though he had no idea why. But Alan showed no reaction. He had drunk a lot of wine and had no ear for hints. Merthyn moved on quickly. "Caris asked me to speak to you about Wulfric. She thinks you've punished him enough for that fight. And I agree."
"He broke my nose!"
"I was there, remember? You weren't an innocent party." Merthyn tried to make light of it. "You did feel up his fiancée. What was her name?"
"Annette."
"If her tits weren't worth a broken nose, you've only got yourself to blame." Alan laughed, but Ralph was not amused. "Wulfric almost got me hanged by stirring Lord William up after Annette pretended I'd raped her. But you weren't hanged, and you cut Wulfric's cheek open with your sword when you escaped from the courthouse. It was a terrible wound. You could see his back teeth through it. He'll never lose the scar."
"Good."
"You've punished Wulfric for 11 years. His wife is thin, and his children are ill. Haven't you done enough, Ralph?"
"No."
"What do you mean?"
"It's not enough."
"Why?" Merthyn cried in frustration. "I don't understand you." "I will continue to punish Wulfric and hold him back and humiliate him and his women." Merthyn was startled by Ralph's frankness. "For heaven's sake, to what end?"
"I wouldn't normally answer that question. I've learned that it rarely does you any good to explain yourself. But you're my big brother, and from childhood I've always needed your approval."
Ralph had not really changed, Merthyn realized, except insofar as he seemed to know and understand himself in a way he never had when younger.
"The reason is simple," Ralph went on. "Wulfric is not afraid of me. He wasn't scared that day at the Fleece Fair, and he's still not scared of me, even after all I've done to him. That's why he must continue to suffer."
Merthyn was horrified. "That's a life sentence."
"The day I see fear in his eyes, when he looks at me, he shall have anything he likes."
"Is that so important to you?" Merthyn said incredulously. "That people fear you?"
"It's the most important thing in the world," said Ralph.
Chapter 57 Merthyn's return affected the whole town. Caris observed the changes with amazement and admiration. It started with his victory over Elfric in the parish guild. People realized the town could have lost its bridge because of Elfric's incompetence, and that jolted them out of their apathy. But everyone knew that Elfric was a tool of Godwin, so the priory was the ultimate focus of their resentment. And people's attitude to the priory was changing. There was a mood of defiance. Caris felt optimistic. Mark Webber had a good chance of winning the election on the first day of November and becoming alderman. If that happened, Prior Godwin would no longer have things all his own way, and perhaps the town could begin to grow. Markets on Saturdays, new mills, independent courts that traders could have faith in. But she spent most of her time thinking about her own position. Merthyn's return was an earthquake that shook the foundations of her life. Her first reaction had been horror at the prospect of abandoning all that she had worked for over the last 9 years. Her position in the convent hierarchy, maternal Cecilia and affectionate Mare and ailing old Julie, and most of all her hospital,
so much more clean and efficient and welcoming than it had been before. But as the days became shorter and colder, and Merthyn repaired his bridge and began laying out the foundations of the street of new buildings he wanted to create on Leper Island, Caris's resolve to remain a nun weakened. Monastic restrictions that she had stopped noticing began to chafe again. The devotion of Mare, which had been a pleasant romantic diversion, now became irritating. She started to think about what kind of life she might lead as Merthyn's wife. She thought a lot about Lola, and about the child she might have had with Merthyn. Lola was dark-eyed and black-haired, presumably like her Italian mother. Caris's daughter might have had the green eyes of the Wooler family. The idea of giving up everything to take care of another woman's daughter had appalled Caris in theory, but as soon as she met the little girl, she softened. She could not talk to anyone in the priory about this, of course. Mother Cecilia would tell her she must keep her vows. Mare would beg her to stay, so she agonized alone at night. Her quarrel with Merthyn over Wulfric made her despair. After he walked away from her, she had gone back to her pharmacy and cried. Why were things so difficult? All she wanted was to do the right thing. While Merthyn was at Tench, she confided in Madge Webber. 2 days after Merthyn left, Madge came into the hospital soon after dawn, when Caris and Mare were doing their rounds. I'm worried about my Mark, she said. Mare said to Caris, I went to see him yesterday. He had been to Malcolm and come back with a fever and an upset stomach. I didn't tell you because it didn't seem serious. Now he's coughing blood, Madge said. I'll go, Caris said. The Webbers were old friends. She preferred to attend Mark herself. She picked up a bag containing some basic medicines and went with Madge to her house in the main street. The living area was upstairs, over the shop. Mark's 3 sons loitered anxiously in the dining hall. Madge took Caris into a bedroom that smelled bad. Caris was used to the odor of a sick room, a mixture of sweat, vomit, and human waste. Mark lay on a straw mattress, perspiring. His huge belly stuck up in the air as if he were pregnant. The daughter, Dora, a beautiful girl of 17, stood by the bed. Caris knelt beside Mark and said, How do you feel?
Rough, Mark said in a croaky voice. Can I have something to drink?
Dora handed Caris a cup of wine, and Caris held it to Mark's lips. She found it strange to see a big man helpless. Mark had always seemed invulnerable. It was unnerving, like finding an oak tree that had been there all your life suddenly felled by lightning. She touched his forehead. He was burning up. No wonder he was thirsty. Let him have as much to drink as he wants, she said. Weak beer is better than wine. She did not tell Madge that she was puzzled and worried by Mark's illness. The fever and the stomach upset were routine, but his coughing blood was a dangerous sign. She took a vial of rose water from her bag, soaked a small piece of woolen cloth, and bathed his face and neck. The action soothed him immediately. The water would cool him a little, and the perfume masked the bad smells in the room. I'll give you some of this from my pharmacy, she said to Madge. The physicians prescribe it for an inflamed brain. A fever is hot and humid, and roses are cool and dry, so the monks say. Whatever the reason, it will give him some ease.
Thank you.
But Caris knew of no effective treatment for bloody sputum. The monk physicians would diagnose an excess of blood and recommend bleeding, but they prescribed that for almost everything, and Caris did not believe in it. As she bathed Mark's throat, she noticed a symptom Madge had not mentioned. There was a rash of purple-black spots on Mark's neck and chest. This was an illness she had not come across before, and she was mystified, but she did not let Madge know that. Come back with me, and I'll give you the rose water. The sun was rising as they walked from the house to the hospital. You've been very good to my family, Madge said. We were the poorest people in town until you started the scarlet business. It was your energy and industry that made it work. Madge nodded. She knew what she had done. All the same, it wouldn't have happened without you. On impulse,
Caris decided to take Madge through the nuns' cloisters to her pharmacy, so that they could talk privately. Laypeople were not normally allowed inside, but there were exceptions, and Caris was now senior enough to decide when the rules could be broken. They were alone in the cramped little room. Caris filled a pottery bottle with rose water and asked Madge for sixpence. Then she said, "I'm thinking of renouncing my vows." Madge nodded, unsurprised. "Everybody's wondering what you're going to do." Caris was shocked that the townspeople had guessed her thoughts. "How do they know?" "It doesn't take a clairvoyant. You entered the nunnery only to escape a death sentence for witchcraft. After the work you've done here, you should be able to get a pardon. You and Merthin were in love, and always seemed so right for one another. Now he's come back. You must at least be thinking about marrying him." "I just don't know what my life would be like as someone's wife." Madge shrugged. "A bit like mine, perhaps. Mark and I run the cloth business together. I have to organize the household as well. All husbands expect that. But it's not so difficult, especially if you have the money for servants. And the children will always be your responsibility rather than his. But I manage, and so would you."
"You don't make it sound very exciting."
She smiled. "I assume you already know about the good parts, feeling loved and adored, knowing there's one person in the world who will always be on your side, getting into bed every night with someone strong and tender who wants to fuck you. That's happiness for me." Madge's simple words painted a vivid picture, and Caris was suddenly filled with a longing that was almost unbearable. She felt she could hardly wait to quit the cold, hard, loveless life of the Priory, in which the greatest sin was to touch another human being. If Merthin had walked into the room at that moment, she would have torn off his clothes and taken him there on the floor. She saw that Madge was watching her with a little smile, reading her thoughts, and she blushed.
"It's all right," Madge said. "I understand."
She put 6 silver pennies down on the bench and picked up the bottle. "I'd better go home and look after my man." Caris recovered her composure. "Try to keep him comfortable, and come and fetch me immediately there's any change."
"Thank you, sister," said Madge. "I don't know what we'll do without you."
Merthin was thoughtful on the journey back to Kingsbridge. Even Lola's bright, meaningless chatter did not bring him out of his mood. Ralph had learned a lot, but he had not changed deep down. He was still a cruel man. He neglected his child wife, barely tolerated his parents, and was vengeful to the point of mania. He enjoyed being a lord, but felt little obligation to care for the peasants in his power. He saw everything around him, people included, as being there for his gratification. However, Merthin felt optimistic about Kingsbridge. All the signs were that Mark would become alderman on All Hallows Day, and that could be the start of a boom. Merthin got back on the last day of October, All Hallows Eve. It was a Friday this year, so there was not the influx of crowds that came when the Night of Evil Spirits fell on a Saturday, as it had in the year that Merthin was 11, and he met the 10-year-old Caris. All the same, the people were nervous, and everyone planned to be in bed by nightfall. On the main street he saw Mark Webber's eldest son, John.
"My father is in the hospital," the boy said. "He has a fever."
"This is a bad time for him to fall sick," Merthin said. "It's an ill-starred day." "I didn't mean because of the date. He has to be present at the parish guild meeting tomorrow. An alderman can't be elected in his absence."
"I don't think he'll be going to any meetings tomorrow."
That was worrying. Merthin took his horse to the Bell and left Lola in the care of Betty. Entering the Priory grounds, he ran into Godwin with his mother. He guessed they had dined together, and now Godwin was walking her to the gate. They were deep in an anxious conversation, and Merthin guessed they were worried about the prospect of their placeman, Elfric, losing the post of alderman. They stopped abruptly when they saw him. Petronilla said unctuously,
"I'm sorry to hear that Mark is unwell."
Forcing himself to be civil, Merthin replied, "It's just a fever."
"We will pray that he gets well quickly."
Thank you. Merthyn entered the hospital. He found Madge distraught. He's been coughing blood, she said, and I can't quench his thirst. She held a cup of ale to Mark's lips. Mark had a rash of purple blotches on his face and arms. He was perspiring, and his nose was bleeding. Merthyn said, Not so good today, Mark. Mark did not seem to see him, but he croaked, I'm very thirsty. Madge gave him the cup again. She said, No matter how much he drinks, he's always thirsty. She spoke with a note of panic that Merthyn had never heard in her voice before. Merthyn was filled with dread. Mark made frequent trips to Malcolm, where he talked to sailors from plague-ridden Bordeaux. Tomorrow's meeting of the parish guild was the least of Mark's worries now, and the least of Merthyn's, too. Merthyn's first impulse was to cry out to everyone the news that they were in mortal danger, but he clamped his mouth shut. No one listened to a man in a panic, and besides, he was not yet sure. There was a small chance Mark's illness was not what he feared. When he was certain, he would get Caris alone and speak to her calmly and logically. But it would have to be soon. Caris was bathing Mark's face with a sweet-smelling fluid. She wore a stony expression that Merthyn recognized. She was hiding her feelings. She obviously had some idea of how serious Mark's illness was. Mark was clutching something that looked like a scrap of parchment. Merthyn guessed it would have a prayer written on it, or a verse of the Bible, or perhaps a magic spell. That would be Madge's idea. Caris had no faith in writing as a remedy. Prior Godwin came into the hospital, trailed as usual by Philemon.
Stand away from the bed, Philemon said immediately. How will the man get well if he cannot see the altar?
Merthyn and the two women stood back, and Godwin bent over the patient. He touched Mark's forehead and neck, then felt his pulse.
Show me the urine, he said.
The monk physician set great store by examination of the patient's urine. The hospital had special glass bottles, called urinals, for the purpose. Caris handed one to Godwin. It did not take an expert to see that there was blood in Mark's urine. Godwin handed it back.
This man is suffering from overheated blood, he said. He must be bled, then fed sour apples and tripes.
Merthyn knew from his experience of the plague in Florence that Godwin was talking rubbish, but he made no comment. In his mind, there was no longer much room for doubt about what was wrong with Mark. The skin rash, the bleeding, the thirst, this was the illness he himself had suffered in Florence, the one that had killed Sylvia and all her family. This was La Moria Grande. The plague had come to Kingsbridge. As darkness fell on All Hallows' Eve, Mark Webber's breathing became more difficult. Caris watched him weaken. She felt the angry impotence that possessed her when she was unable to help a patient. Mark passed into a state of troubled unconsciousness, sweating and gasping, although his eyes were closed and he showed no awareness. At Merthyn's quiet suggestion, Caris felt in Mark's armpits and found large boil-like swellings there. She did not ask him the significance of this. She would question him later. The nuns prayed and sang hymns, while Madge and her four children stood around, helplessly distraught. At the end, Mark convulsed, and blood jetted from his mouth in a sudden flood. Then he fell back, lay still, and stopped breathing. Dora, his daughter, wailed loudly. The three sons looked bewildered and struggled to hold back unmanly tears. Madge wept bitterly.
He was the best man in the world, she said to Caris. Why did God have to take him?
Caris had to fight back her own grief. Her loss was nothing compared with theirs. She did not know why God so often took the best people and left the wicked alive to do more wrong. The whole idea of a benevolent deity watching over everyone seemed unbelievable at moments such as this. The priests said sickness was a punishment for sin. Mark and Madge loved one another, cared for their children, and worked hard. Why should they be punished? There were no answers to religious questions, but Caris had some urgent practical inquiries to make.
She was deeply worried by Mark's illness, and she could guess that Merthyn knew something about it. She swallowed her tears. First, she sent Madge and her children home to rest, and told the nuns to prepare the body for burial. Then she said to Merthyn, "I want to talk to you." "And I to you," he said. She noticed that he looked frightened. That was rare. Her fear deepened. "Come to the church," she said. "We can talk privately there." A wintry wind swept across the cathedral green. It was a clear night, and they could see by starlight. In the chancel, monks were preparing for the All Hallows Dawn service. Caris and Merthyn stood in the northwest corner of the nave away from the monks, so that they could not be overheard. Caris shivered, and pulled her robe closer around her. She said, "Do you know what killed Mark?" Merthyn took a shaky breath. "It's the plague," he said, "La Moria Grande." She nodded. This was what she had feared. But all the same, she challenged him. "How do you know?" "Mark goes to Malcolm and talks to sailors from Bordeaux, where the bodies are piled in the streets." She nodded. "He's just back." But she did not want to believe Merthyn. "All the same, can you be sure it's the plague?" "The symptoms are the same. Fever, purple-black spots, bleeding, buboes in the armpits, and most of all the thirst. I remember it, by Christ. I was one of the few to recover. Almost everyone dies within 5 days, often less." She felt as if doomsday had come. She had heard the terrible stories from Italy and southern France. Entire families wiped out, unburied bodies rotting in empty palaces, orphaned toddlers wandering the streets crying, livestock dying untended in ghost villages. Was this to happen to Kingsbridge? What did the Italian doctors do? Prayed, sang hymns, took blood, prescribed their favorite nostrums, and charged a fortune. Everything they tried was useless. They were standing close together and speaking in low tones. She could see his face by the faint light of the monk's distant candles. He was staring at her with a strange intensity. He was deeply moved, she could tell, but it did not seem to be grief for Mark that possessed him. He was focused on her. She asked, "What are the Italian doctors like, compared with our English physicians?" "After the Muslims, the Italian doctors are supposed to be the most knowledgeable in the world. They even cut up dead bodies to learn more about sickness. But they never cured a single sufferer from this plague." Caris refused to accept such complete hopelessness. "We can't be utterly helpless." "No, we can't cure it. But some people think you can escape it." Caris said eagerly, "How?" "It seems to spread from one person to another." She nodded. "Lots of diseases do that. Usually, when one in a family gets it, they all do. Proximity is the key factor." "That makes sense. Some say you fall ill from looking at sick people." "In Florence, the nuns counseled us to stay at home as much as possible and avoid social gatherings, markets and meetings of guilds and councils."
"And church services?"
"No, they didn't say that, though lots of people stayed home from church too." This chimed with what Caris had been thinking for years. She felt renewed hope. Perhaps her methods could stave off the plague.
"What about the nuns themselves, and the physicians, people who have to meet the sick and touch them?"
Priests refused to hear confessions in whispers, so that they did not have to get too near. Nuns wore linen masks over their mouths and noses, so that they would not breathe the same air. Some washed their hands in vinegar every time they touched a patient. The priest physician said none of this would do any good, but most of them left the city anyway.
"And did these precautions help?"
"It's hard to say. None of this was done until the plague was rampant, and it wasn't systematic, just everyone trying different things."
"All the same, we must make the effort."
He nodded. After a pause, he said, "However, there is one precaution that is sure."
"What's that?"
"Run away." This was what he had been waiting to say, she realized. He went on, "The saying goes, leave early, go far,
and stay long. People who did that escaped the sickness.
We can't go away.
Why not?
Don't be silly. There are 6,000 or 7,000 people in Kingsbridge. They can't all leave town. Where would they go?
I'm not talking about them. Just you.